From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Is this the time for Latinos to take to the streets to demand deeper immigration reform? Some say maybe not.
The thinking in the movement now is that the large marches are not necessarily the most effective. What they're really doing is organized to lobby.
But before implementing reform, make sure the border's secure, say many people. For one Arizona rancher, high-tech cameras and steel barriers just aren't enough.
The border should be secured. Why should I have to live in a no man's land?
And an American woman turns into a coyote, a human trafficker, just for the money, but comes face to face with the consequences in the form of a girl.
Quiero a mi mamá, maldita coyote.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Quédense con nosotros. Stay with us. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Well, it's the end of March, and still no firm immigration reform plans, just as Congress breaks for the Easter vacation. We address some facts behind the rallying cry for more border security. Michelle Marisco reports for the Fronteras Desk from Arizona on how border security works right now and just how effective it is.
Nearly 200 vendors from all over the country traveled to the Border Security Expo in Phoenix, Arizona earlier this month. They were there to show off their inventions, weapon modifications, and camera technologies. They were vying for those profitable Homeland Security contracts.
It's water resistant, not waterproof.
Art Kreutz is with Radiant Technologies Incorporated. He was selling a platform designed to stop a car by zapping it. The concept is simple. A car being chased runs over the platform. Someone pulls a switch, then a 150,000-volt pulse kills the engine.
You could put this anywhere out in the desert, turn it on, and anything that runs across it, it will kill it.
Others were selling miniature drone surveillance planes, tricked-out Humvees, and indestructible laptops. This is the modern face of border security, at least through the eyes of those wanting to sell it.
Alert 5. 865-469.
But this is what it really comes down to. Two men sit facing a wall of computer screens in the communications room of the U.S. Border Patrol station in Nogales, Arizona. They see what the massive cameras mounted along the Mexico border see. A single figure is standing near the looming border wall that separates the two countries. He makes the camera operator suspicious.
He's talking to someone to see if it could coast clear.
Security here has become a massive slice of federal law enforcement spending. $18 billion last year alone on immigration and port security. That was more than on drug enforcement, the FBI, and gun investigations combined. The Border Patrol alone more than doubled in size in the last decade to more than 21,000 agents. Homeland Security has built 650 miles of steel barriers all along the border. So, is it working? And if it is, how do we measure that?
91-298.
Andy Adame is a spokesman for the Border Patrol's Tucson sector. On a cold winter morning, he's driving on a dirt trail set against a backdrop of yellowing grasses and looming mesquite trees toward the border fence.
19, can you give me a 21 again,
please? In this part of Arizona, a decade ago, the border was defined by strands of cheap barbed wire dividing the two countries.
You don't see that anymore. This, in order to cross this, you better be 18 to 40 years old and in good physical condition in order to get up and over this.
30 feet of steel bars above ground and 6 below. It can absorb a pickup truck ramming into it at 55 miles an hour. Now, here's one measure of success Homeland Security always points to. Apprehensions across the entire border have dropped significantly, down 47% in 2011. That's due to both increased security like this fence and high-tech cameras, but also the poor U.S. economy. But this measure hasn't convinced everybody. Take Congressman Ron Barber in Tucson. That question of how to measure what's called operational security of the border has gone on so long that he finally asked the Government Accountability Office to study what's been spent and what's been accomplished. He also hosted a pair of border security hearings this winter trying to answer the question. He wasn't impressed.
I've traveled the border with ranchers. They wanted me to see firsthand how many Border Patrol agents patrol the fence or the wall. And I spent the better part of a day with one rancher and I saw two vehicles. So clearly that's a problem.
Jim Chilton is one rancher who agrees. He lives 19 miles north of the U.S.-Mexico border in the small town of Aravaca. His cattle ranch runs all the way down to Mexico, and he's seen it all. Dozens of people arrested just back behind his house. Spotters working for drug runners laying up in the hills on his ranch watching for agents. Despite Homeland Security's claims, Chilton says the job isn't done.
The strategy and policy should place Border Patrol people at the border. The border should be secured. Why should I have to live in a no man's land?
For its part, Customs and Border Protection has said it will design a plan that finally defines for itself what operational security of the border really means and how to measure it. That answer will come next November. Meanwhile, early proposals on immigration reform say any plan must satisfy border residents like Chilton that the border really is secure. For Latino USA, I'm Michelle Marisco.
From the border to the halls of Congress now, we're in Washington. The cherry blossoms around the Capitol won't be blooming till next month, but immigration proposals from both sides of the aisle seem to be sprouting up like springtime weeds. To talk about all things immigration and for an update on where things stand now, we're joined by Pilar Marrero. She's senior political writer for La Opinión in Los Angeles. Bienvenida de nuevo. Welcome back to Latino USA, Pilar.
Happy to be here, Maria.
Pilar, so first, give us a quick update on the most recent immigration proposals coming from the Senate, the Obama administration, and any other ones that may have some weight.
Well, we have two sets of groups meeting at this moment, and they have been meeting for a while. You have the Gang of Eight in the Senate, formed by four Republicans and four Democrats. And you have another gang of also eight in the House who are meeting in a parallel way, and they are talking about some of the principles that they would like to see on an immigration reform bill. There's actually not a concrete proposal out yet, and both the House and the Senate are talking about putting something out by the end of March or maybe when they come back from the Easter break in the second week of April. Now, the White House also put out their own framework. So that's it so far. So far, it's been a lot of talk and not yet a concrete bill.
What about national Latino organizations like National Council of La Raza or LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, or unions? Do they have a seat at the table? And is that seat one of raising hands and pushing, or is that seat one of we're here to work with you in whatever circumstance we can?
All of these Latino national organizations have lobbyists and people who are working either in Washington or at the local level. And they're all, you know, pretty much on board with the idea that there needs to be a path to citizenship and that there needs to be a broad immigration reform. There's others like the National Immigration Forum, which are doing very interesting work with the conservative communities. For example, they have this project with the evangelical community and the business community and the law enforcement community. And they're working sort of on the right side of the spectrum. There's the unions. Before, the unions used to be split. You know, FL-CIO and SEIU used to be split. The SEIU would have a more progressive stance, and the FL-CIO would be, you know, very suspicious of the temporary worker programs. Now they've sort of tried to unify their position and say, well, you know, if there's going to be some kind of temporary worker program, there needs to be rights that be given to those workers so they're not abused and that doesn't, you know, affect them, et cetera, et cetera. So all the groups are working at different levels on this immigration reform. But of course, you know, the Gang of Eight, when they meet, they don't invite all of those groups. They meet amongst themselves. But those groups are meeting with the president. They're meeting, you know, they're meeting with individual congressmen. They're plotting different ways of pressuring for what they want. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people that are active right now on this issue.
Are we seeing major pushback, let's say, on the ground from young people, from Dreamers, from activists, from citizens who are supporting this? Are you expecting to see protests along the line in the sense of, you know, this is another form of pushing for democracy, but from the street level in more civil disobedience? Is that happening?
Well, we remember back when the Sensenbrenner Law was passed in 2006, you know, people went to the streets and we had the large marches. The thinking in the movement now is that the large marches are not necessarily the most effective, and that what they're really doing is organized to lobby and to actually use the democratic pathways that we have, you know, the phone calls, the pressure, the, you know, the faxes or the emails to the congressman or to the senator. I think the groups are a lot more organized and they have more support. You know, as an example, you have the evangelical Christians, you know, the Christian community, and some of the Southern, you know, Baptist groups that were very conservative and that weren't really on board with immigration reform before, they're now on board. But on the other hand, you have very strong movements coming from the ground, for example, to include the gay and lesbian community. And those two, the evangelical and the gay and lesbian community, may clash. There's a lot happening and there's a lot of movement more than ever before. But at the same time, there's some differences there that need to be solved.
Now, Pilar, even if a bill were passed and signed by the summer, let's say, and there's anger over some other elements, perhaps, of what is not included in immigration reform, what could that engender in terms of a reaction from Latino voters? Will they say, my gosh, you know, we went to the polls, we did all of this, and now you gave us something half-baked? Or are you concerned about what will happen with the Latino electorate, which is, of course, one of the fastest growing in the country?
Well, it's hard to tell what will satisfy Latino voters. I imagine that if they get a reform that legalizes a large number of the undocumented that are present in the country and that gives other avenues for people to immigrate here legally, I don't think Latinos are unreasonable. And I don't think they expect everything that they want in this immigration reform. But I think the most important thing that they expect is respect to ourselves, to our immigrants, to people who are here, not committing any crimes, but actually just working and doing what every other set of immigrants did back in the day. So I'm not so afraid that people are going to be turned off. I have hope that there's enough fear in these politicians that, in particularly on some of the Republican side, that they really need to take care of this. And the Democrats, if they don't really come forward with something that's effective, that Latinos are just going to rethink, you know, what the political path should be for Latinos in the future.
Pilar, thanks again for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Pilar Marrero is a senior political writer for La Opinión. She joined us from the studios of KPCC in Pasadena, California. Coming up on Latino USA, a look at President Obama's pick for Secretary of Labor.
He's a very bright, capable lawyer. He has done a remarkable job on the ground, especially when it comes to voting rights.
Thomas Perez, the administration's pick for labor chief, and the first Dominican to ever be appointed to a cabinet. That's coming up. No se vayan. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. After several months of criticism over the lack of diversity in his cabinet picks, President Obama has nominated a Dominican-American to be Secretary of Labor. If he's confirmed, Thomas Perez, who's now Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, will move to head the Labor Department. He'll take the place of another Latino, Hilda Solis, who resigned as Labor head last January. Andrew Cohen is a contributing editor for The Atlantic and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. Welcome to Latino USA, Andrew.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So Thomas Perez is not the most recognizable name in U.S. politics. Give us a bit of background. Who is this guy and why name him to head labor?
I can share some insight into who he is. He's a very bright, capable lawyer. Harvard Law educated, went to Brown, and he has done a remarkable job on the ground at the Justice Department, especially when it comes to voting rights. He was a central figure last year in the run-up to the 2012 election in filing Voting Rights Act cases against some of these state officials who tried to suppress votes, South Carolina, in Texas, in Florida. It was Thomas Perez and his section in the Justice Department that went to court and said, look, this is wrong. This has to be stopped. So the good news for supporters of Mr. Perez is that he has this track record of being very efficient and effective as a lawyer, as an advocate.
All right. But what might be the points of opposition? The Office of the Inspector General just released a report following an investigation into the Justice Department's voting rights section, and they brought up a few things. Could these be used as fodder against him?
Sure, I think so. And I mean, that's going to be the flip side of this. The Inspector General report did find that there is still a level of mismanagement in the Justice Department left over from the Bush era. The criticism this week was that the Obama administration, including Attorney General Holder, including Mr. Perez, didn't move quickly enough to sort of root out some of that partisanship and that lack of professionalism. And I think if we're going to see a line of attack that's going to get some traction, it's going to be that one.
Now, according to Mother Jones, this is what they said. The president will be elevating one of the most effective and progressive senior administration officials to his cabinet. He did, in fact, sue anti-immigrant Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio.
So, yes, that's going to be one of the things that's going to come up. Now, of course, that, you know, riles some folks, right? The folks who are concerned about states' rights and local autonomy and so forth. But I think the one example in Maricopa County is an example that was well chosen by the administration to say, look, we don't care what your politics are. You can't do this to other people. You can't disrespect the federal authority when it comes to civil rights, even if you're a very popular sheriff.
All right. Well, thanks for speaking with us, Andrew.
It's my pleasure.
Andrew Cohen is a contributing editor at The Atlantic, a legal analyst for 60 Minutes, and he's also a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. He joined us from his home near Denver, Colorado. Plenty of films have shown the experience of Mexican immigrants crossing the Rio Grande in search of a better life. But a new movie, out this month, is about an American woman who crosses the border into Mexico while searching for her own American dream. The Girl is directed by David Riker and tells the story of a down-on-her-luck single mother in San Antonio. When social services takes her son away from her, she tries smuggling immigrants into the U.S. in order to earn the money to get him back. On the way, she comes across a young Mexican girl who changes her life. Film critic Cristina Davila blogs as the Chicana from Chicago, and she joins us from the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas. Welcome back to Latino USA, Cristina.
Thank you.
So tell us about this main character. Her name is Ashley. Who is she, and what role does she play?
Ashley, played by Abby Cornish, is the American, beautiful, blonde, blue-eyed, but struggling single mother in South Texas. She's trying to regain custody of her son. She's kind of a mess. She's barely getting by. She chain smokes, drinks, and has a resentful, kind of victimized attitude that stems from the frustration and anger she feels for having her son taken away and deemed unfit as a mother. So she's desperate and believing that all she needs is money to prove to social services she's equipped to take care of him, she risks being a coyote. And I feel that the film really is able to give a lot of credibility to that scenario.
One of the things that I did love about this film was the little actress, Maritza Santiago Hernandez, who plays the girl who is left behind when her mother dies as they're crossing the Rio Grande. And what I like about her is how direct she is about how she's feeling. Let's take a listen.
Dijiste que nos ibas a llevar a Austin.
¿Qué?
¿Por qué nos dejaste en el río?
Hice lo que todos hacen.
Quiero a mi mamá. ¡Maldita coyote!
Shh.
So what do we know about this young actress, Maritza Santiago Hernandez? Is she like David Riker in his first film, La Ciudad, using people from the community who then he turns into actors? Is that the case?
Yes, from what I understand, David spent lots of time in Oaxaca and lots of time just meeting families, and that's how he came across Maritza, who he said immediately struck his attention because she was so direct. She is this precocious, resilient, but also really sensitive child, and I think that she has a natural magnetic quality that translates on the screen.
Director David Riker has dealt with immigration before. Again, he wrote La Ciudad. He co-wrote Sleep Dealer with Alex Rivera, who directed it. So what do you think makes this film unique? Do you think it's actually going to play with a mainstream audience that they will identify with this trafficker as well as with this little girl?
He is in this film also kind of playing with some of the themes that Alex Rivera and him conveyed in Sleep Dealer, the terrific, chock full of fascinating contemporary themes. For one, he also presents to us a world in Mexico where it's not full of poverty and negative stereotypes, but it's very rich and vibrant. And so he's playing with these misconceptions that we have.
We'll see how the movie plays. It's called The Girl. And thank you so much for speaking with us, Cristina.
Not another.
Film critic Cristina Davila lives in Southern California. Her blog is called Chicana from Chicago. She joined us from the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas. For this week, that's Latino USA. If you have any comments or suggestions, call us on the phone at 646-571-1228. You can also friend us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. We are Latino USA, all one word. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, Deborah George, Andres Caballero, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Annie Correal, and Michael Jones. We also had help from the Fronteras Desk, a public radio collaboration in the Southwest, focusing on the border and immigration issues. Additional production this week from Michael Simon Johnson. Latino USA is produced by The Futuro Media Group in Harlem. Our program was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm executive producer Maria Hinojosa. Join me again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Latino USA is funded in part by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. And the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And Lumber Liquidators, supporting the Ronald McDonald House Charities, the National Braille Press, and NPR. Information at lumberliquidators.com. And the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to a vigorous presence for poetry in American culture. Poetryfoundation.org. This is NPR.